Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. What do wine, beer, and cocktails have in common? They're all liquid, and water plays a part in each of them. On this week's show, we'll hear from Andrew Nations of Shreveport's Great Raft Brewery about the water there. And then Bruce Cakebread of Cakebread Cellars talks about the lack of water there. And then we'll make some ice cubes with water and hear from the Washington Post's award-winning columnist Jason Wilson about how he combines a life of cocktails and travel writing. We're very fluid on this week's Louisiana Eats. Talk to anyone in the spirits industry, and you'll learn that even 80 years later, we're still dealing with the damaging effects of Prohibition. As little as 2 years ago, brewers in Shreveport were still trying to deal with restrictive local laws that dated back before Prohibition. We met City Council Representative Jeff Everson outside of Herbie K's in Shreveport for the lowdown on how Shreveport breweries got caught up with the rest of the state.
You know, once we really started hearing from two breweries, one of whom is Great Raft, who really took the lead on a lot of developing the policy necessary to have a full-scale brewery, you know, we started working with them to find out what provisions are there in our local laws that don't allow this. And there were quite a few. There hadn't been a reason to review it in a long time. So this gave us that reason, and it gave us that chance to change the laws. I think it is an important reminder for all of us to take a look at when industries evolve, that our laws need to evolve as well.
And evolve they did. Great Raft's co-founders, Andrew and Lindsay Nations, worked with Jeff to help clear out the cobwebs from 100-year-old regulations, consulting with everyone from police to city planners to fire marshals. By October of 2013, the restrictive zoning regulations were lifted, and change could begin.
When Great Raft finally had their products available for commercial sale, I did get the privilege of buying the first beer produced in Shreveport since Prohibition, and it was a brew that they call Reasonably Corrupt. It's a dark brew that has some pretty funny political connotations, but I took it as an honor, so it was a treat.
After chatting with Jeff, we had to check this place out.
Hey, how are you? So this is my first time here.
I barely tasted my first sampler of a fruity pale ale called Commotion when the bartender announced a guided tour was about to begin.
Hello, welcome to Great Raft. My name is Andrew Nations. We got some folks recording some audio, so this is awkward for me, but whatever. Well, thank you guys for coming out and taking the tour. What we'll do today is kind of tell you a little bit about what we believe in terms of brewing lagers. And kind of walk through the whole process of a typical brew day. Other than that, have fun. And again, ask questions. I like to talk about beer and drinking beer.
Andrew certainly didn't have the appearance of a founder and owner. He had on a baseball cap and was sweating a little bit more than the rest of us, probably because of the hot and humid nature of working in the brewery. But basically, he just looked like any of the patrons visiting the brewery that busy Saturday afternoon. There were twice as many people lining up for samples in the adjacent tap room as there were on the tour.
So the name Great Raft, for those of you who don't know, is a reference to the Great Red River Raft. Back in the 1830s, was basically a log jam, but it was 100 miles long. At one point, you could walk across the Red River because it was so dense with logs and debris.
That log jam was torn down with snag boats by Henry Miller Shreve, Shreveport's namesake. This opened up the Red River as a waterway and led to a period of prosperity for the city.
For my wife and I, we really wanted a name that resonated with locals and had something to do with local history beside, you know, Lindsay and Andy's Lane Brewery. So that's how we came up with Great Raft.
Andrew then explained that Great Raft is classified as a production brewery, which means they can only sell 10% of their production on site. He also explained what it means to be a craft brewery. The key words here are small, independent, and traditional.
Small meaning under 6 million barrels a year. Independent meaning we're not owned by some massive conglomerate, Miller Coors, AB, some other out-of-country, out-of-state businessmen. It's just my wife and I and some other local businessmen that have a lot more money than I did. Traditional meaning we use traditional ingredients in all of our beer. We only add things in the beer that make it awesome and make it taste great and, for the most part, traditional.
Andrew has a real affinity for German beers. So if you're familiar with Schwarz beers, the black beers with a chocolatey flavor, or light pale ales from the Spaten Brewery, then you'll like Andrew's palate. You won't be alone. Within their first 3 months of operation, Great Raft exceeded their expectations for the entire first year.
We're just trying to keep up at this point. We're making lager. It's not a fast turnaround. It's not as bad as bourbon, but it's still about a month, right? We can't rush that. The beer has to taste the same way every time you have it, but it's a struggle to keep up with Shreveport. We're very grateful to be working as hard as we are. We're expanding, and we'll get there.
Andrew makes about 700 gallons of beer every time they brew, about 40 kegs worth. In his pursuit of quality, he sources the finest ingredients from around the world, but has to use local water to produce his beer.
Let's talk about Shreveport water. So Shreveport water is crap. If you guys don't have a Brita filter, please go to Target, drop a 20, invest in your family's future. What that means for us is we have to control that, right? So we make light lagers. Like, again, that beer has to taste the same every time you try it. So we use a process called reverse osmosis.
What does that mean? The reverse osmosis process strips out the mineral content of the water, allowing Andrew to mimic the flavor profile of any water from around the world.
Dublin, Portland, Asheville, San Diego, if I have a water report, we have that flexibility. So we have different water profiles for our lager, different water profiles for our hoppy beer. But ultimately, in a nutshell, what it means is great control, right? We control our water regardless of what the city's doing. The algae bloom in the summer, it just gives us that control, and we really need that for doing light lagers like we do.
On a typical brew day, the head brewer will arrive around 8, and once the water reaches the proper temperature for brewing, he'll drop milled malted barley into a mixer. Here's what happens next.
So think about it this way. All we're trying to do in the mash mixer, we're converting the starches to sugars. So if you think about it, we've just added really, really hot water to this malted barley. It's a cereal grain, right? It gets kind of mushy, kind of like oatmeal. Well, I don't want oatmeal. I need somewhat clear sugar water. At this point, it's called a wort, unfermented beer.
The wort gets sent through a machine that separates the spent barley from the now flavored water, and it's on to the next step, balancing the beer.
Let me get a sip of beer. Let's not get crazy here.
Then the beer goes into a kettle for an hour-long boil, and hops are added to give bitterness to the beer. You'll get different flavors depending on how many hops you add. Hefeweizens won't have many hops, while a double IPA will wallop you in the face with their bitterness.
I want to pass around some hops here. This is American Simcoe hops. I love this hop. I can't get a lot of it because it's one of the sexy hops that you can't get. But really open it up, crack it open. You're trying to get your hands really sticky and smell that resin. The resin is the part that makes it. There's some orange juice in there. There's some orange zest, very tropical. But it really gives you an idea of what that hop is about. So there's different hops. We give you onion, mint, spice. It's an open door. You can do anything you want to with hops.
Hops are usually added twice at this stage in the game. The first time for bitterness, the second for aroma.
So you ever seen the wine guys holding, like, don't do that because we're beer guys, right? It's very smart because they're getting air into that wine, right? They're getting some of that aroma because they know a large part of what you smell is how you perceive taste. Don't make a show out of it. Again, we're beer guys, but definitely pour your beer into a glass because we need that aroma to taste.
Once the hops have been added and the beer is cooled down, it's time for the fermenting to begin. This is when yeast is added to convert the sugars to alcohol.
Let's go down here and we'll talk about packaging.
If it were up to Andrew, he'd have everyone drink straight out of the tank. No such luck, though. Instead, like many craft breweries in Louisiana, Great Raft cans on site.
So we canned all day yesterday. It was pretty brutal, but we got 600 cases done. So cans for us, I mean, they're better for the environment. I don't think Shreveport even recycles glass, which is crazy. But cans are kind of a perfect vessel for us. You can take them on the golf course, on the boat, particularly in this part of the world. It's best for us.
At the tour's conclusion, we toasted Andrew's success with one of his delicious craft brews. I looked around the room and saw people playing a game of beanbag toss, dining at the food trucks out in the parking lot, and smiling over beers with folks they had just met. It made me think about something Jeff Everson had said hours before.
I really think that if you want people to move somewhere, stay there, be connected to it, feel a part of it, then you have to get them into the culture of the place. You feel a lot more of a part of your community when you're dining at places or hanging out in places that are telling a part of that story. And, you know, so it's both economically and socially vital.
Tours of Great Raft's brewery are provided regularly on weekends, and flagship beers like Southern Drawl Pale Lager can be found at retailers throughout Louisiana. For more information, visit greatraftbrewing.com. A Great Raft beer makes a perfect pairing for a spicy bowl of chili. There's nothing better than chili to warm you up in the winter or cool you off in the summer than the effect of those spicy peppers. Scott Gold's here to talk about his love of the many types he's come across in his lifetime.
It should probably come as no surprise that I have a significant history when it comes to chili. Ah, yes, good old chili. A big bowl of red. It's one of the finest single-bowl menu items on this side of creation. Growing up in New Orleans, there were always satisfying soups and stews to be enjoyed in the Gold House, from dark roux gumbo with chicken and sausage to a classic turtle soup au chéri made in the Galatoise fashion, and everything in between. And then, of course, there was occasionally chili. I didn't give chili much thought as a youngster in Louisiana. It just seemed like something Mom would throw together cheaply and quickly to feed a family of three boys and a hungry husband on the days she didn't feel like spending numerous hours in the kitchen. Chili was always good, but generally unremarkable, especially compared to other dishes Mama Gold was known for, like her inimitable crawfish etouffee and a chicken marsala that, to this day, I have yet to find an equal. As I became an adult, and then a food writer, chili somehow took on a larger place in my heart and in my life. As we've come to know it and love it, chili, or chili con carne, rather, is actually an American invention. It's not easy to find a quality bowl of this stuff elsewhere, and when you do, it's rarely the heady, spicy, complex bowl of rich, meaty goodness that chili aficionados know to be the real deal. There's also the matter of meat and or beans. I generally prefer my chili in the Texas style, very meaty and without using beans as a filler. I will acknowledge the existence of vegetarian chilies, but that's about as far as I'll go on that score. To me, chili means meat. Most veggie chilies I've encountered are little more than spicy bean and tomato soup, more minestrone than good old American chili. And when it comes to the meat part, I'm a big believer in cheaper cuts of steak like chuck and round, and if not that, then lean ground beef. Ground turkey is fine, if uninteresting, but usually when I think of chili, I think of a big old steer and the cowboy who's going to ride and then eat him. That said, alternative proteins can be great as well, especially if you have hunters in the family who have plenty of venison on hand after a weekend in the woods, or moose, caribou, even wild boar. The single strangest chili I've ever encountered was, in fact, one of my own design, a spicy tequila-spiked rattlesnake chili I cooked while doing research on a book I was writing about all things meaty and delicious. All I can say about that experience can be summed up thusly. Make sure you poach your snake and remove the meat before putting it in your chili pot. Otherwise, you'll wind up with a bowl filled with hidden snake ribs and fragments of spinal column, which might put your dinner guests off their appetite a bit. Then, of course, there are the extras. A great bowl of chili shouldn't need anything extra piled on top to make it satisfying, but let's be honest, Fritos pretty much make everything better. Not to mention sour cream, green onions, shredded cheddar, and an extra hit or two from the hot sauce bottle. Oh, and beer. Definitely beer. Chili also makes an outstanding breakfast, by the way. Throw a couple of fried or poached eggs on top of your Texas Red and boom! You've got a killer start to the morning, whether you're headed off to rustle some cattle or just on your way to a desk job. Above all, though, just make sure that some hot chili peppers are involved, because everybody knows the chilies in your chili will always keep you from being chilly.
That was food writer and native New Orleanian Scott Gold. His Food Porn Fridays column can be found each week at nolavie.com. What wine should you use for cooking? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What wine should you use in cooking? For starters, never use anything that says cooking wine on the label. Did you ever notice they're on the grocery store shelf next to the vinegars? That's a big red flag. You wouldn't put that in a glass and drink it, would you? That's the best place to begin. Never cook with anything that you wouldn't drink. Often, the best wine to use in a dish is one that would pair well with it at the table. There are six main styles of cooking wine: dry reds and whites, dry or sweet nutty oxidized wines like sherry, Marsala, or vermouth, sweet fortified red wines like port, sweet white wines like Rieslings or Sauternes, and rice wine. How do you choose which kind goes in a dish? Read the recipe. Most of the time, your roadmap is there. Just remember, a little for the pot, a little for the cook, and everything will be just fine. I'm Poppy Tooker, and this is Louisiana Eats.
So I'm Bruce Cake Bread, president of Cake Bread Cellars. Within Napa Valley, 95% of the wineries are family-owned. Some are very, very small or, you know, independently owned. But what's the strength about family-owned businesses, whether you're making wine or widgets, is, you know, they will go to the nth degree to make sure that they're doing the best product out there. Usually they always have this, I want to be able to give this to the next generation. We're all just kind of caretakers of the business, and we're moving it on. And so it's, you're just passing the ball. You know, when we plant a vineyard, we're looking at, you know, the wine coming off there. We won't drink it for 10 years. So we start taking the long-term view, and that plays really well into a family business, because family businesses around the world always take that long view, because they're not looking at it as just like the quarter or the year. They're looking at the next generation. And I think that's the strength of family businesses and wine. That's kind of a match made in heaven on that one.
Bruce Cakebread grew up with a passion for the outdoors. When he was still a teenager, his family bought land in Napa Valley, where they created Cakebread Cellars, a winery that today produces some of Napa's finest wines. It was an obvious choice for Bruce to study viticulture and food science in college. He graduated and joined the family business in the late 70s. He's found success by ensuring a happy workplace and always putting the customer first. But there are certain things he can't control, things that could ultimately harm the family business.
I hope it rains. We were fortunate we had two storms come through, and it didn't go through the whole state. And so when people say, hey, how's the drought? We go, we're fortunate. Other people in other different parts of the state will kind of go, uh-uh. You know, I'm taking sponge baths and, you know, yellow water in the toilet is normal. So that's agriculture. You know, you kind of live and die with the weather.
It's hard to control Mother Nature, and nothing's more unpredictable than weather, so what can he do? There's no clear answer, but Napa Valley's tightly knit community is thinking creatively about ways to collaborate on water use. For a 35-mile-long strip that's home to more than 450 wineries, collaboration is everything.
We sponsored a fermenter over at UC Davis. It's a research fermenter. It's a 2-ton fermenter. costs a fortune. And so Roger Bolton, who's a professor over at Davis, who I took classes from back in the 70s, he came to us and said, you know, we're looking for 16 families from the California wine industry to sponsor these fermenters. So they're kind of expensive. And I said, Roger, you know, I could buy like 10 tanks for that. And he goes, well, the beauty of these tanks is they can use 90% less water to wash them, to be able to operate them, than what you traditionally use. So this was when we had a lot of water and not during the drought. And I was like, well, yeah, big deal. But now you kind of see the vision of what he was looking at. And he said, well, if you don't have water, you can't make wine. And so it is very, very true. And so the students going through that university get trained, this is how you make wine. And so that to me is kind of a strength of the university system, because the most valuable resource is going to be those students graduating saying, here's how you got to change your operation. Because, you know, we're old codgers and it's like, well, this is the way we've always done it. But they're going to bring new ideas. And that to me is really, really important so that we can learn to say, oh, okay, there's another way.
That's so visionary, because it's so vital to be open to what's coming next and to encourage that. Yeah. You really blew me away when we were out in the wine fields the other day in the vineyards, and you began to talk about all of the various efforts that you all are making, from parking lots to reservoirs, when it comes to addressing the water situation. What are you doing?
So we start out with the river restoration. So it's the landowners up and down all banding together, say we want the river to go back this natural way. And so, of course, in Napa Valley, we want the healthiest river in all of the, you know, North America to be in our middle of our valley. And so it's not a government regulator, it's not regulations being put down. It's the landowners saying, hey, we want this. So then you kind of start stepping back and saying, well, what's running into that creek and into the river? And so it's going to be runoff off our parking lot. And so then I got this weird idea, and actually from a gentleman down at LSU, he was an inspiration of, hey, you guys can do this and this and this. And it's trying to use every square foot of that parking lot a couple different times. As we've developed, we're creating like a 3-acre kind of biodiversity island within the middle of Napa Valley, because you drive up and down Highway 29, you see grapes everywhere. And so we're going to be that island where the birds can come, the bees can come, and be able to have that island and keep Napa Valley healthy in our little Oakville, Rutherford region, because we'll have that biodiversity. And so that's a pretty exciting and kind of a journey that kind of you start putting in all these pieces together with the research fermenter to reduce the water, having a natural river, and then being able to say, well, we want to make sure everything that comes off our footprint is clean that goes in that river. It's just all these pieces that kind of come together. And so we're pretty excited about it.
Well, when it comes to natural resources, one of the ones that you're sitting on right here is that you have a natural underground water well. Mm-hmm. You know, there's water there. Tell us about the water that exists already here.
So what we've done is the county and the landowners got together and said, here's what's going on with our wells, the groundwater, how much we're pumping, all that information. We gave it to a groundwater advisory council committee that the county ran, that anyone who wanted to participate could participate. So we have, you know, like 15 wells up and down the valley floor. Some people think it's top secret. We think it's information to be shared, because we're all putting our straws in the same kind of bowl. And so if that bowl goes dry and we don't know about it, we're all in the same boat. If we can understand how that groundwater operates, then we're all in a little bit better situation. And so Napa Valley is very fortunate, because we have the two hillsides, the Mayacamas and the Vaca. So all that water runs down and we're sitting in this basin. And so the study that they did this past year is the groundwater up and down the valley floor hasn't really moved too much. The next study is to say, well, what's going on up in the hills? Because they don't know. And so that's the next study, is to get people who have wells up in the hills to say, hey, what's going on? Is it going to be much more difficult because the rock is all fractured, and what might happen over here might be different there. So it's not like the valley floor. But if we don't collect the information, you're like running down a tunnel with your eyes closed. So it's not a good way to make a decision. And what we found in Napa Valley on all the different challenges, whether it's hillside ordinance, winery definition, traffic, if we have good data, we can make good solutions. If we just have opinions, usually things don't work out so well. And so one of the things we've learned as a community, come up with good data and, you know, let's measure it. And then we'll figure out this is the best solution for the community.
You have been changing some of the patterns of your planting when you're planting new vines. And you all are changing some of what you've been doing with the planting.
You're absolutely right, because we're looking at row directions to get the sunlight to come more evenly on the fruit instead of, you know, all on one side in the morning and all on the other side in the afternoon. So this is kind of a knowledge that we've learned over these 40 years. And so you take row direction, you take how we do our canopy management, you're adding all those things together. And what it's going to come up with is, I think, just like UC Davis came up with, you know, this research fermenter, I think there's a vineyard of the future that is very, very different than what you see, stakes in the ground and wire and all that type of thing. You know, you take all the new technology that's going on, and people always think that it happens in the winery. But there's more new technology going on in vineyards and agriculture, just not vineyards, but agriculture in general, to be more efficient, to, you know, get higher quality than what's going on in the wineries. And the wineries, quite frankly, we're making our wines very simply, because if you get good grapes, I think the process goes simply there. In the vineyards, they're saying, you know, how do you understand? And so you'll see, you know, I know this sounds kind of odd in today's world, but you'll see drone technology for agriculture just going to boom, because you can cover more ground. You can get more data in on what's going on with that vineyard by being able to measure it on a weekly basis very efficiently by programming it, a drone to go up and down, measuring green in the vineyard. I have this kind of funny thing, you know, it's like, well, what would the new vineyard 20 years look from now? And it's like, maybe there's no tractors. Maybe whatever equipment's on there is like on a little rail that just goes up, and it's like a train. And, you know, something you guys like, well, it's like, wow, what could happen? And yeah. So that's Napa Valley. And so, but everyone has that kind of same thing as protect the valley, because, you know, Robert Mondavi, Jack Davies from Schramsberg, you know, my father, all these guys gave us our generation, the next generation of winemakers, this great foundation of Napa Valley. It's our responsibility to give it to the next generation in a better way, that's more enhanced, but also preserved the way it is. So it's kind of a delicate balance, but that's our responsibility to the next generation.
Thank you, Bruce. It's wonderful to talk to you, and it's really wonderful to get to know you and your family right out here in the vineyard. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks for making the time.
That's Bruce Cakebread, president of Cakebread Cellars. Stay tuned to Louisiana Eats throughout 2015 as we examine the issues of drought, water conservation, and ecology. Julia Child's name came up twice recently. Once in a cooking class, when a visitor from Paris told me she'd learned to cook from Julia Child's famous tome, Mastering the Art of French Cooking. Then, from a beginner cook who proudly told me she just cooked Julia's coq au vin. Coq au vin is an ancient chicken stew made with bacon, onions, mushrooms, garlic, and, most importantly, a hearty red wine. The French word coq means rooster, and originally the dish was made with an old bird well past his prime. That sinewy old bird was delicious after a long simmering braise, but a chicken will do just fine for your coq au vin. Dice some thick-cut bacon and brown it in a heavy Dutch oven. Remove the bacon from the pot and use that rendered bacon grease to brown chicken pieces that have been seasoned with salt and pepper. Let the browned chicken rest while you sauté some chopped onions and carrots in the pot. Add some mushrooms and sauté them, too. Stir in about a tablespoon of tomato paste and cook it for just a couple of minutes. Then, return the chicken and bacon to the Dutch oven and cover everything with a combination of chicken stock and red wine. Add some garlic, thyme, and a bay leaf. Bring everything to a boil, then cover the pot and reduce it to a simmer. Often, I'll cook my coq au vin in a 325-degree oven for an hour or so until the chicken is falling off the bone. To finish it, I add a drained jar of pearl onions and tighten the sauce with a beurre. This is a fantastic trick I've learned that quickly thickens and enriches the sauce at the same time. Work together equal parts of butter and flour, almost like you're making a pie crust. Then whisk that into the hot liquid. The trick is to serve the coq au vin at once, because if it simmers for more than 5 minutes, you'll taste the raw flour, and you'll need another 20 minutes or so of cooking. I serve coq au vin over rice with plenty of hot French bread. Sound good? You'll find my recipe on our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com or at wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Registered dietitian Molly Kimball is always full of fun ideas to improve our lifestyle in delicious ways. Molly, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Oh, thank you so much for having me here.
What are we talking about today?
Oh, I think it's most people's favorite topic, wine.
Wine. Healthy?
Wine is definitely healthy. You know, it certainly does have its health benefits. There's a lot of misconceptions, though, and misperceptions about what the health benefits actually are. And a lot of us think it's limited to just red wine, and the reality it's not.
So, Molly, walk us through the different colors of wine and tell us what your thoughts are.
Okay, so hands down, red wine is the most nutritious, if we would say it that way, of any type of alcohol. But first, backing up a little bit, all types of alcohol actually help to lower our risk of heart disease. And that's because alcohol itself helps to raise our good HDL cholesterol. Now, that's one of many reasons. It can also help lower our stress levels if we have alcohol, you know, moderately in social situations. There's a host of reasons that alcohol in general is linked to a lower risk of cardiovascular disease. Red wine takes it even further, though. So the grape skins and seeds are pressed in the red wine, and they're retained in there. And those are actually really high in antioxidants that we don't get from white wine or other types of alcohol. So it is true that red wine does have even more health benefits and health components, but all types of alcohol actually can be, quote, healthy for us.
So I guess that red wine is almost a superfood.
Right. You talk to certain people and they might put it in one of their food group categories, right? They consider it a fruit or, you know, yes.
Well, that's super news. So what about white wine?
So white wine is not bad. And I would say one of the biggest myths about white wine is people think that white wine is high in sugar. And they may say, and here's the thing, a lot of times people may like red wine okay, but they really prefer white. But they'll try to make themselves stick with red instead of white because they think they should, or they think that white is higher in sugar. The reality, though, is that ounce for ounce, they're right about the same amount of carbs and same amount of calories. There's really trivial bit of difference. Another thing is a myth is that wine is high in sugar, and it's not. So it does have a few grams of carbs, about 6 grams of carbs for a normal pour glass of wine, but very, very low sugar, almost none at all to speak of.
What about the wines that you see on the shelf with labels like skinny me, skinny you, skinny something? Is one wine really skinnier than the next?
Well, here's the thing. With any of those skinny drinks, almost always the way that they are lower calorie is because they're lower in alcohol content.
Oh.
So if you don't mind a watered-down margarita, wine, whatever else it might be, that's fine. And for a lot of people, that can actually be better, not only from the calorie perspective, but also if you're at an event where you're going to be having multiple cocktails or drinks throughout that event, it's a good thing maybe to have that lower alcohol content. But that's usually how those drinks are going to have fewer calories, is lower alcohol.
There's a lot to be said for those slowly melting ice cubes,
right,
in the glass.
Exactly,
too, huh?
Exactly. So, and it is all, when we talk about what moderate alcohol intake is, what's defined as moderate is not more than one a day for women, two for men. And in New Orleans, that's not an easy thing for a lot of us to do. So
no.
It is kind of finding out what works for you. So if you know that you're someone who tends to drink things quicker, then we're going to need to add, maybe if you're having regular wine and not one of those skinny types of wines, maybe do your spritzer, you know, add some club soda, or even, you know, the horror that, you know, sommelier might have, add the ice cubes to the wine, whatever it's going to take. That, again, if you are at that event, how are you going to keep it balanced so that you're not making a scene.
That's always a good idea. Right. And hard in New Orleans sometimes,
right. It can
too.
Be a challenge for sure.
Molly, does it really make a difference if wines are made organically?
So the from a calorie nutrient type perspective, it really doesn't make much difference if you have an organically grown wine or not. However, when we look at what the difference is with organic type of farming, less or no or very minimal chemical pesticides, no synthetic fertilizers. So and a lot of us, that's what we're looking for, to incorporate fewer of those things. So if that's important to you, then wine that's made with organic grapes is going to be a better choice. And they've really come a long way as far as taste and flavor. Now you'll notice that you don't see it called organic wine. And that's because water cannot be certified organic. So what you'll usually see on the label will be made with organic grapes, and that's how it's really identified, because that entire wine itself with the water included, the whole thing is not organic. It's just those grapes that have been raised in that organic process.
That is really fascinating.
And I'll tell you, some of these organic wines, one of my favorite is actually from Preston Vineyards out in Sonoma. I don't know, and I've asked the winemaker, and he just thanks me because I love it so much. But it's when you look at it in your glass, it is so thick and so rich. And so it's I don't know if it's the organic process, if it's whatever else he's doing there, but it looks and tastes and even just has that mouthfeel that's completely different than in any others.
That's another truth about drinking wines. If one glass of fine wine is going to take a longer sipping time than maybe something a little lesser that you might slug down.
Huh? Right. Exactly.
Amazing. That fine wine goes a long way. What about sulfites in wine?
Well, a lot of people think that, oh, I can't drink red wine. It's high in sulfites. That gives me a headache. Well, the reality is that it's probably for the majority of us, it's not the sulfites that are giving us a headache. So what it actually is in red wines that is usually going to be responsible for that headache is tannins. And so what tannins are, when we drink it and we kind of get that astringent taste where it feels like it's drying our tongue or puckering our mouth, that's going to be a highly tannic wine. And that's usually going to be what's giving us the headache. So when you're looking at what do I do to avoid that, white wines can be lower in tannins. And the older a wine is, the less tannic it tends to be. So that's usually going to be the culprit, not necessarily sulfites. So if you're paying extra money for that sulfite-free wine, you may not be really getting all that you're paying for.
Well, we've talked about the health benefits. Tell me, Molly, you're going to a party. You can have one drink. What is the best from both a calorie and health point of view?
I would say have whatever. If you're just going to have one drink, first and foremost, I prefer it to be very low in sugar. So if it's red wine, if it's white wine, if it's a beer, you know, when we look at a normal pour glass of wine, it's about 150 calories. A good beer, like an Abita Amber, 128 calories, actually. If we're looking at about an ounce and a half to 2 ounces of whatever liquor, we're looking at about 130 calories. So they're all pretty much the same as long as you're avoiding sugary mixers, sugary add-ins. So if you're having just one, I would say have whatever you enjoy, and I'm proud of you for having just one.
Well, thank you, Molly. Thanks so much for bringing us this amazing information about wine and alcohol.
Right, and thank you so much for having me.
When we come back from the next break, we'll meet Jason Wilson and learn exactly what a peanut Lolita is. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Jason Wilson is a man of many talents. His resume includes work as a travel writer, journalist, teacher, and restaurant critic. But Jason's probably best known for his award-winning drink column in the Washington Post. Here's Jason Wilson about cocktails and his career.
You know, if I had tried to have this life path, I think it never would have happened, right? Because what I originally wanted to be was a novelist, the great American novel. And I went to, you know, MFA school and spent many years trying to write what it was probably the worst novel of all time. And abandon that, as one must.
As one must.
And I thought, you know, travel writing, well, okay. As a younger person, I was traveling to, you know, I guess more edgy kind of places, right? And as I got older, you know, I thought, well, you know, really what I wanted to do was go to Italy, right? And write about Italy, right? I think like my whole trajectory of travel writing was I wanted to write about Italy, but like the magazines would never give me an assignment about Italy. They would give me an assignment about Haiti or Nicaragua or Iceland. So, you know, I think that path leads one to, you know, food writing. Food writing leads to wine. And I've always been a great spirits enthusiast, so that led to spirits writing, you know.
Though Jason never did get to write the great American novel, he cleverly combined cocktails with travel writing in his 2010 book, Booze Hound, on the trail of the rare, the obscure, and the overrated in spirits.
Booze Hound grew out of the column at the Washington Post, and I wrote that for 6.5 years. And my editor there came to me in, I don't know, late 2006 and said, you know, we were talking about what columns I might write, something humorous. And he was saying, you know, spirits are beginning to get really big. I mean, think about spirits and cocktails in 2006, right? I mean, we're talking, right. It's like cave paintings or something,
yeah.
Right? You know, and so, and I think at that time, you know, there were some good guys writing about it, like Dave Wandrich and stuff, but a lot of the people who were writing about spirits were like tied to the brands, you know. It was like very much like the cocktail pieces you would see would be like sort of sponsored by, you know, mm-hmm. one of the big brands or something. And I think early on I kind of – one of the things I did was like I was not beholden to the brands. I mean I wrote for the Post. I mean I didn't take sort of consultancy sort of things. And so I just sort of said it how I felt it, you know. And when Booze Hound came out, there was a – you know, one of the big liquor companies, one of the big conglomerates, you know, offered me a very – very lavish book tour, you know, and
wow.
Right. I mean, but I think what always protected me with that is that the Washington Post, like a lot of good newspapers, has a very strict ethics policy, right?
Yes.
So there's only so much you can do, right? There's just so much money in this industry. It's crazy money. And so you can see why, like, it's taken so long for really, like, drip by drip, like this craft cocktail movement or craft spirits or whatever. It's just, I think it's different than wine. Like, I write about wine a lot, too. And wine is a lot of, you know, there's big producers, sure. But, like, I think the backbone of wine is, like, family producers, right? I mean,
yes.
And so I don't know. My relationship with the big brands is I'm not a hater. I don't, you know, I think too many people are haters. Like, look, there's a lot of bad craft spirits, just like there's a lot of bad, you know, bad big, you know, big brands. I mean, it's,
yeah.
You know, it's... And there's a lot of great...
It's just an exciting, you know, time to
exactly.
be drinking.
Yeah, exactly. Right, yeah.
Well, you know, a lot of people that do similar travel, food, and drink writing become very lofty about it and really almost snobbish. And I see you as the antithesis of that. And, you know, I think Booze Hound is, you know, the hardcore evidence. And in Booze Hound, you chronicle what... It's called The Rare, The Obscure, and The Overrated in Spirits. I'd like you to tell me what's overrated in spirits.
Overrated.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when I wrote the book, you know, this is a couple years ago. I mean, it was vodka, of course, right? But I think everybody's both over, like, the vodka trend and then also over the backlash of vodka, right? It has to normalize in some way. So I'm like, you know... So overrated is the vodka backlash, really, you know, at this point, right? I mean, this is the way trends go. So, but I think now, I don't know, you know, I think overrated is a lot of the sort of high-minded role-playing of like the, I'm your craft bartender, I'm your mixologist, right?
Yeah.
I'm your coctologist, right? Whatever,
yeah.
you know, and sort of like, you know, I think that is overrated at this point. And you see a lot of your really good bartenders are getting back to like very simple menus, like taking something like the gin and tonic and making it interesting, or taking something like, I don't know, just like an old fashioned, you know, getting back to sort of the basics.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe cocktails in general are overrated these days. I don't know. I
mean, what's your favorite cocktail?
Mine, I think the Red Hook, you know, which is a Manhattan variation. The Red Hook, which is rye, maraschino, and punta mace, right?
We don't see that much here in New Orleans.
No.
No.
Well, at one time in a column, I called it the prototypical cocktail of the aughts, right? Of the cocktail renaissance, you know, in New York, because it was like rye and an Italian. It was a twist on a Manhattan. It was like a rye, a bitter, and something else, right? And it was like, you know, and you named it after a borough, and that was how it went, you know.
One of the most obscure drinks mentioned in Jason's book is a liqueur called Peanut Lolita. Jason explains.
Peanut Lolita was found – I have to credit my brother Tyler with finding Peanut Lolita, because we played this game for years called Liquor Store Archaeology. And we would scour the dusty corners of these old school liquor stores, you know, in Jersey or whatever. And he found this bottle called Peanut Lolita. And it is a sort of – it's a peanut liqueur. It's peanut whiskey liqueur. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the trail sort of runs cold, and we did some digging, and it was I guess it was launched in the 70s. And the strange historical fact of it is that Billy Carter, you know, the presidential brother, Billy Carter, was the brand ambassador at the time.
Of course he was.
Yeah. And Peanut Lolita is what's funny is I have been cornering the market on it, and I have people that like tweet at me and send me bottles and things. They've read it, you know. I actually owe one guy a book for what he sent me. So I have like a number of bottles, and I open them from time to time for people. Half the people hate it because it just tastes like whiskey and peanuts, basically. But other people like they love it. They love it. My brother loves it. He makes a drink called the PB&J, which is Peanut Lolita layered with some Chambord, right? And that's like the PB&J, right?
That's fabulous.
It's disgusting. What a name, though, right?
It's really great. Do you have any idea why it was called that?
Well, the bottle – I wish I had a bottle here now. The bottle has a very – like it's like a young girl, you know, on the front of it. You know, it's sort of – I don't – like I'm sure – it sounded like a good idea in 1972, right?
Yeah, sure.
With so much knowledge to share, it's no surprise that Jason teaches classes on wine and spirits as well as travel writing. I asked him what advice he gives to students who would like to follow his career path.
The writing is really hard, right? And it's a very difficult thing. And if you want to do it, you have to be serious about it. And that's the thing. I mean, for all the joking and... oh, you know, lifestyle and like, you know, this idea that maybe you'd walk around with a monocle and a scarf and an ascot or whatever, you know, but it doesn't work. You know, it's like it's very hard work, you know, wine writing, drinks writing, food writing, travel writing. The second part of that is always the writing, right? Which is done alone in a room.
Requiring a lot of discipline.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good point because so many people have this idealized thought, and you know, it springs maybe from being that great American novelist that you figured out early on wasn't going to happen. No. And look at the success that you've achieved. So, okay, well, Jason, you have been such a wonderful, generous fellow to take time and come and talk with us on Louisiana Eats. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Jason Wilson, spirits writer and author of Booze Hound. On the trail of the rare, the obscure, and the overrated in spirits. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Dickie Brennan and Company. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to managing producer Thomas Walsh and associate producer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.